This is Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Democrats and President Trump are at an impasse over the partial government shutdown. We'll talk about that with Congressman Jim McGovern a little later in the program. But first, Senator Elizabeth Warren will campaign in Iowa this weekend, having just announced her intention to run for president in the way that modern candidates announce their intention to run for president by establishing an exploratory committee. Sounds very exciting. Warren spoke to reporters on Beacon Hill this week, saying her campaign is about listening to people around the country.
I am in this fight because I believe that government is working for the rich and the powerful. I believe that Washington is corrupt. I see it firsthand. That's what pulls me in. That's why I'm in this fight.
WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks will be there for Warren's first event later today in Council Bluffs, Iowa. He joins us now from right next door in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Evan. Nice to talk to you.
I'm getting a geography lesson, too. Omaha, Nebraska, right next to Council Bluffs, Iowa. So where are you exactly?
Yeah, I'm in Omaha, Nebraska, right next door to Council Bluffs, Iowa. And that's where Elizabeth Warren is going to be beginning this two-day, this weekend-long series of campaign events, really, from one end of the state, here in the western end of the state. In a few hours, she'll be in Council Bluffs, then tomorrow, Sioux City, then a roundtable in Storm Lake, and then a big organizing event in Des Moines, all the way at the other end of the state, and a fifth event on Sunday. So, Evan, this is really, you know, about Elizabeth Warren testing her appeal and her message in this all-important first presidential caucus state.
No, I mean, listen, she's testing her message. What kind of sort of reception is she expecting to get?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's the big question. I mean, she hasn't campaigned here in about 4 years, so in a way, she's sort of reintroducing herself. And I think there's some excitement out here. A lot of the diehard Democratic caucus goers, I think, are going to like her message of economic populism, of the hollowing out of the middle class, of dealing with corruption in Washington. I think she's also going to face the same kinds of questions that are raised back in Massachusetts, and that is a liberal Harvard professor from blue state of Massachusetts electable? So I think she's going to be dealing with those questions as well. But, you know, if you look at the polling, and I hesitate to do that, but here goes.
The polling the a year Register, and a half in advance of any policy.
Yeah. So the Des Moines Register, and that's good to offer that caveat. CNN and the Des Moines Register polled just last month, and likely Iowa caucus voters, Democratic caucus voters, 65% of them view her favorably, 20% unfavorably. That's pretty good. She's running fourth behind Joe Biden, Beto O'Rourke, and Bernie Sanders. But let's not talk any longer about polls for an event that's 13 months away.
So, yeah, I mean, it's sort of surprising to me that we're even talking about Iowa. Is this still the way that campaigns are run? You go and you have to impress people in Iowa first, then New Hampshire. I mean, have we not learned anything about the diversity of America or the power of social media? Is it still old-fashioned, on the ground, I'm in Des Moines?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And of course, I think modern campaigns have learned something about the power of social media. I mean, Barack Obama certainly showed us that. However, we still are stuck in this all-important first caucus, then the all-important first primary in New Hampshire. That's where a lot of the focus is going to is going to be. And the point of what Elizabeth Warren is doing right now is in what could be a very crowded field of Democrats with upwards of 20 candidates. She's really getting the stake in the ground early and really getting this organization together early.
Yeah, very
early. That's going to give her an advantage. At least that's the thinking. Because she's already attracting. Okay, consider this. She's already raising lots of money. And it's interesting as well that she's already snapped up some key campaign workers. Here are some names that are probably not going to mean a lot to the average listener. But just this week, She hired Brendan Summers. So he managed the 2016 Iowa campaign of Bernie Sanders. She snapped up Emily Parcell. She was the political director for Barack Obama's winning Iowa caucus campaign in 2008. She also hired a couple of other people who managed successful Democratic campaigns just this past November. So it's a real sign that she intends to compete, and she intends to compete statewide. And snapping up these campaign workers has created a bit of a buzz, at least in this early stage.
Well, it's interesting because it's something
2020 race.
It's something concrete to be done. You know, it seems kind of strange to try to appeal to voters this far in advance, but to pick up key operatives this far in advance, that starts to make strategic sense.
It makes strategic sense, and I think it puts pressure on other people who may jump into the race but haven't yet. And by sort of planting her flag in the ground, raising money early, snapping up these key campaign operatives early on, you know, she's at least trying to make a case that at this point she's a credible front runner. But a long way to go to Iowa, 13 months.
A long way indeed.
Precise.
That's WBUR's senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. He'll be in Iowa, traveling across the state for a couple days, and he'll have updates from there on WBUR all weekend. Anthony, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure, Evan.
So from Anthony, let's stick with this topic and start our Week in Review, our weekly Friday Week in Review right here with Elizabeth Warren in Iowa preparing for a presidential run in 2020. Marianne Marsh, a Boston-based Democratic political consultant, says Warren's anti-Trump message can help her in the primaries.
If you're a Democrat, you are measured by the strength of your opposition to Donald Trump. And for Elizabeth Warren, first to market is a smart move.
Meanwhile, Peter Ubertasio, a dean and political scientist at Stonehill College, points to challenges that Warren will face.
You know, she's going to bring some negatives to the table. She is not extraordinarily popular nationally. She will be characterized as an elite, out-of-touch, liberal professor.
With me in studio are Ed Lyons. He's a Massachusetts Republican activist, a political writer, a Twitter maestro. How you doing, Ed?
Thanks for having me back. Happy New Year.
No, Happy New Year to you. Also with us, Susan Tracy. She's the president of the Democratic consulting firm, The Strategy Group. She's also a former state rep. How are you doing, Susan?
I'm good. Thanks for having
me. And your new year, starting off well?
So far, so good.
Are you going to Iowa?
Not anytime soon.
So I do want to reassure listeners. I mean, I keep harping on this, but you didn't sleep through an entire year, right? It's January 2019, not January 2020. Warren is way out ahead of the rest of the field at this point, a field that Democrats are expecting to get pretty crowded. Ed, too early?
I think it's too early for everybody. I think this is a time of great dynamism and confusion in American politics. Anything can happen. It seems like hiring operatives a year before the caucuses seems kind of crazy to me.
Susan?
I don't know if it's crazy. I think that she's, you know, everyone's going to make a strategic decision based upon what's best for their campaign. I think Elizabeth Warren feels like I'm going to get in early. You heard Anthony talk about, you know, grabbing some senior operatives quickly out of the gate. That's going to put pressure on other candidates. It gives you an opportunity to start to raise money. It gives you a ground game's important. You talked about New Hampshire and Iowa. She's going to get on the ground before everybody else. I mean, I think it's a smart strategic move. She's got some negatives, as we talked about. I think she wants to get deal with them early. So it's probably a smart move for her campaign.
So one theory mooted by Jeff Berry, a political science professor at Tufts, is that it's actually about one potential competitor in particular, Bernie Sanders.
She's very intent on pushing him out of the race as quickly as possible and getting Sanders' 2016 supporters on her side and building up a coalition.
Ed, what do you make of this? That is, before Warren can be the credible voice on progressive economic issues, she has to be the lone leading voice on progressive economic issues, and that means getting ahead of Sanders.
Sure. It seems like there's a lot of energy in the progressive part of the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders did very well with that group last time. I think that she is concerned about having him as a competitor. But because there are doubts about Senator Sanders right now, perhaps she's trying to just deal with that right away and not, you know, wait a few more months to see what his plans are. So I think that it seems like a valid strategy for her.
Now, polls, this keeps coming up, the sort of likability question, right? She's viewed unfavorably by a substantial number of potential voters, especially men. Now, part of that may be tied to missteps like recent effort to quiet questions about her claims to Native American ancestry by taking a DNA test. But Peter Beinart, a professor of journalism at NYU, wrote in The Atlantic, here's a quote, the better explanation for why Warren attracts disproportionate conservative criticism and has disproportionately high disapproval ratings is that she's a woman, end quote. I also like the headline from the satirical website McSweeney's, runs like this. I don't hate women candidates. I just hated Hillary. And coincidentally, I'm starting to hate Elizabeth Warren. Susan, is the unfavorability question at root about sexism?
I think there is sexism. I mean, there's a reason why we've never elected a woman as president. The one thing I would say that's really interesting going into this cycle is I think women are sick of it. And I think
sick of what?
Sick of the treatment of female candidates, sick of, you know, this likability issue being the first thing out of the gate, sick of what, if you make one mistake, pouncing on it. And I think I'll give you an example of where you see that. Nancy Pelosi. I think when people started to say, oh, she's too old, she, you know, we got to get rid of her. I think you saw women come out in droves and say, I mean, Seth Moulton certainly felt it up at a town meeting that he had. I think it was in Amesbury. I think you take one look at our Congress and look at who was elected this year and look at the diversity. I think it started the day after Trump got elected. I think it started with the women's marches, and I think the Me Too movement, and it's continued. So I think the dynamic exists for women, but I think the pushback is going to be stronger than ever.
Ed, am I right to think you disagree?
No, I do think there's sexism. In my Republican world, I mean, all I see are things in social media about how terrible she is, pictures of her always screaming at something.
There is a lot of venom.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah. She has definitely triggered Republicans around the country to view her in an extremely negative way, and conservative media always shows her as being negative. It's so bad that I have friends who can't understand how she was reelected because it's such a universally negative view of Senator Warren that I think that it's people shouldn't underestimate how deep the dislike is of her in a certain part of the population. I do think a lot of it is sexism, though.
One person who is excited about her running is President Trump, who spoke with Fox News after her announcement.
Well, I'm happy about it. I think she'll be wonderful. I hope she maybe gets the nomination. That would be a wonderful thing for me.
Might he be right here, Susan? Would it be a wonderful thing for him if she runs, if she gets the nomination?
No, I think whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be savvier and smarter than I think we have been in the past with him. And I think, you know, Trump, it's a classic Trump move to go after whom he's afraid of the most.
Ed, you think he's right to want to single her out as someone he could challenge more easily, beat more easily?
No, I just think that she's seems familiar to him, that he's used to criticizing her, that she's on the national stage already. And I think he's looking forward to someone he believes he understands, although I don't really think he understands Senator Warren.
All right, enough of the national stage then. Let's talk from the Republican president to our Republican governor. Sounds like a short jump, maybe a giant leap.
For mankind.
He is known as the country's most popular governor. He began his second term this week.
It's incumbent on us to pursue these tasks with foresight, intelligence, and commitment, so that we can rest assured that when our time is done, those who come after us will be able to build on the foundation that we've established.
That's from the inaugural speech he gave yesterday. We spoke with WBUR's Anthony Brooks about it at the time, and he said it was really true to Baker's persona, focused on practicality.
This was vintage Charlie Baker. It was a practical to-do list, not a big, bold vision thing list.
But Senator Karen Spilka, who was just elected to her first full term as president of the Senate, was calling for a bold vision.
The time for small ideas and incremental change is over. We cannot let the political battles of today prevent us from conquering the complex challenges of tomorrow.
Ed, you've been hearing this kind of criticism leveled at the governor now ever since he became governor, probably before that. What do you make of this incrementalist charge against the governor? And what did you make of the speech?
I thought the speech was really good. I think he showed great pride in our state politics, how productive and civil that they are. And when he declared that and how he's proud to be here and all the people around him in the state house, really loud applause from legislators and people who were watching. I think I felt great about being from Massachusetts watching that speech. as far as being incremental, I think he's making progress in so many areas. He spent time in the speech talking about the fact that a lot of things, a lot of areas getting better at the same time really does matter to the people, and that the everyday work of government, if it improves, really helps a lot of people, and that we shouldn't underestimate all the government does and all the ways it can get better. And I think that means a lot to ordinary people, although I think for commentators, they want to hear some big vision speech rather than hearing that, you know, life will continue to improve.
Yeah, one of the things he talked about, which I thought was kind of a very moving moment in the speech, was being part of changes that take place across maybe decades, across various administrations. You can't fix education in one term. No governor deserves credit for that. It takes multiple governorships. You can't fix transportation. Susan, what did you make of that way of putting it?
Well, I thought Baker's speech was who Baker is. You know, he has been a very sort of steady bipartisan leader. He's a nuts and bolts guy. Sometimes I hear him talk about his mother being a Democrat and his father being a Republican, and I think that kind of sums up how he governs. He has a bipartisan lifestyle right out of the gate. You know, it is who he is. You know, look, I'm a Democrat, but I'll give him credit. I think, you know, people have liked his leadership. Whether 4 years of kind of steady she goes, you know, will start to get old remains to be seen. But clearly he won with a big margin, and people like the steadiness and the even keel that he's been running the Commonwealth in.
And he has some – I mean, he laid out plans for doing a number of things on education, on transportation, took pride in the progress made at the MBTA. Ed, if you were advising the governor, what do you think his top priority should be in the second term?
Well, I don't advise the governor.
If you were, that's the hypothetical. That's the hypothetical.
I would say stay the course, of course, and you know, look for, you know, things that aren't, you know, sexy but matter. Things like transparency in government. I think that our state really is way behind in terms of transparency. I think that there should be an agreement between the different branches of government on really improving that. I'd like to see technology get better in terms of you know, the way that Baker really did this huge reorg of technology in the state a year and a half ago. Nobody noticed, even though technology is the oxygen the whole government breathes. It's how we do everything. And I'd like to see more work done on tech. And of course, I want to see the MBTA get better like everyone else. But I happen to know what they're doing, so I have confidence in that.
Susan, I won't imply that you're advising the governor, but if you found yourself in that position, is there some issue you would really encourage him to tackle?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I'm the governor and I'm in my second term and I've got 4 years, I think I'd ask myself at some point, I've got this opportunity to make a mark on the Commonwealth for the long term. And what do I want that to be? And is it, you know, I left a rainy day fund and the budget was balanced? Or is it I took on something big and I really tried to make a fundamental difference for the future? You know, you'd have to think that the areas that you'd look at for that would be in the environment or in transportation. I just feel like those are so fundamental to the future. And they probably take some money, and maybe that's one of the reasons he's kind of gun-shy to take on a big mm-hmm. initiative.
There's also education. I mean, this is one of the it was one of the things that didn't quite happen, right? We got very close to reorganizing school funding. It broke down in negotiations between the Senate and the House last year. So it's a big issue. We know various branches want to tackle it. The governor has talked about it. What do you think the prospects for success for changing the way we fund schools in Massachusetts, Ed?
I think it's good because the legislature is interested in. I always think it's interesting to hear legislators say that Jolly Baker should have this bold vision. I thought, like, isn't that your job? I think the legislators represent the people. That's where the big ideas should come from. If Jolly Baker says we're building a monorail to Springfield, it won't matter if the legislators don't want to fund it and build it. So I do think that I want to see the legislators do that, and I think they are interested in changing the education funding formula. I do think they are interested in measures to try to close the achievement gap. So I think because they're interested and Baker's interested, we're going to see progress.
I mean, just to emphasize this point, Speaker DeLeo hinted that if Baker was really committed to this issue, he should have made clear what his preferences were. He said one reason the bill fell apart was because the governor hadn't given his input on the issue of education.
As opposed to last session, and I'm hopeful that, you know, maybe that may make things a little bit better to see where exactly he's coming from on this most important subject.
I mean, I don't want to harp on it, but this gets to the point. Like, he's the Speaker of the House. He could be pushing forward legislation, and here he is blaming the governor for not advancing this across the line. Susan disagrees with
me. Yeah, I look at that a little bit differently. If you look at the branches of the, you know, you look at the House and the Senate and the governor, in my opinion, the governor is the person who represents the entire Commonwealth, and he or she should have the bold, big ideas. Legislators fundamentally represent small geographic portions of the state. They don't represent the whole state. So I would disagree that sort of big statewide ideas should come from a legislature. They should, I think the leader of the Commonwealth should have big ideas, and legislators should work with them to make sure that districts around the Commonwealth are benefit from those ideas.
Well, let's finish with a couple of minutes on an issue where the governor and the legislature recently worked together. This is the standoff between National Grid and its 1,200 locked out workers, which seems to be nearing an end. After nearly 36 weeks, the parties have reached a tentative agreement, though we still don't know the terms. WBR's Bruce Gellerman says the unions are set to vote on Monday on whether to approve the compromise.
They've got to rent a hall that can accommodate the 1,250 gas workers, and then a majority of members of both unions have to ratify the new deal.
And it's not just the workers breathing a sigh of relief. Real estate developers have been vocal about the fact that this long lockout has made it hard to get gas service turned on in new buildings.
This is still a construction project, but theoretically it's all done. And I'm not making money on it. I can't do anything with it because I can't occupy it yet.
So I just want to get a few facts on the table before we dig into this. One, it's a lockout, not a strike, meaning the company stopped workers from coming in when their last contract expired. Two, the big sticking points, and again, we don't know the final resolution, were health insurance, where National Grid wants workers to contribute more, and the possibility of switching from a pension system to a 401k-style contribution system. The governor, the legislature, they passed a bill just last week which extended support for benefits for workers, unemployment insurance benefits for workers, and so got really involved. Ed, did you think they were doing the right thing by getting involved in this issue?
I do think things are different for utility companies. I think the politics changed after the gas disaster in Lawrence. I do think that they were concerned about the economic consequences of the strike continuing. So I think it was a very special case, even though National Grid was talking about typical corporate concerns in terms of cost. So I do think it was a one-off. I don't think it's sort of a precedent. I'm uncomfortable weighing into a labor dispute when there's a really good union involved. I kind of think when you have a good union, that's what they do. But here, I think because of the issues I mentioned, I think that the state had some role in to get involved.
Susan, do you
I think Ed makes good points there. I think that the legislature and the governor got involved because there was a lot of pressure from lots of other places, not just the employees, but the development community and cities and towns. And I do think that what happened up in the Merrimack Valley cast a different light on this issue. So I think there are a lot of factors here that made this
right. It became
reason.
A higher profile
Absolutely.
Issue because of the explosions
Absolutely.
In the Merrimack Valley. Right.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. And that changes the willingness of legislators and lawmakers
to get involved. Absolutely.
Do you think it signals that there's a deeper problem with the way we structure our public utilities? That is, should lawmakers in general have more control, more say over what get of the pay to workers, the conditions under which they work at public utilities, Ed?
Well, I think that those kinds of industries are heavily regulated to begin with. The average person probably doesn't know the degree to which that we regulate all kinds of energy companies. There's a lot of rules already in place. I would think that if the government got more involved in terms of, you know, labor or, you know, compensation, all that, I think they would just become eventually just part of the government. So I really don't want them to get involved on a long-term basis. I'm okay with them tactically trying to solve this, but then I want them to go away and let the unions deal with this with the electric power companies.
So another impact of this is that the lockout left completed construction projects in Massachusetts unable to open as they awaited gas. One is the Acadia apartment building in Chelsea with 34 units of affordable housing, including 8 for people who are homeless. Everything's ready to go, but they still need gas service. Here's Rafael Maris, the executive director of Neighborhood Developers.
Having that many households waiting to move in after they've been selected is a situation we've never had before. It is particularly heartbreaking to think that people spent the holidays homeless when they had an apartment waiting for them.
Is there any way, Susan, to compensate for this, whether for developers who lost money in this process as the long lockout continued because they couldn't get gas service, or for people who were denied housing? Or is this just one of the side effects of ongoing labor disputes?
I can't imagine how you would quantify that to be able to do that kind of compensation. I think what's most important is we get those people into those homes as soon as possible.
And if, presumably, if the union ratifies the contract, we will be able to start turning on more gas service for more businesses and more locations, and that will happen.
Get back to normal.
All right. Finally, let's do hubbubs. Brief stories or events that caught your attention this week, that is, caught the attention of Susan and Ed, but you think didn't catch enough of our listeners' attentions, then they should be alerted to it. Susan.
My hubbub is the swearing-in yesterday of Nancy Pelosi on two fronts. One was her adorable granddaughter, Bella, who whooped it up every time her grandmother's name was mentioned or put into, put into consideration for a vote. It was really quite adorable to see. But then I love the way Nancy Pelosi picked up on that moment and invited everybody's kids up onto the rostrum with her. And then she opened the session for the children of the country. And I just thought it was really touching. It was just a really touching moment, and I loved it.
It's like a heartwarming moment.
Yeah, it was.
In Congress.
It was great.
We don't get enough
see all
heartwarming
those kids.
Moments in
we
Congress.
We don't. Yeah. Loved all those kids up there.
Ed, your hubbub.
It is this month is the 100th anniversary of the great molasses flood in Boston, a really unusual, unnatural.
Yeah, this is an incredible story.
A really unusual, unnatural disaster that happened in the North End, January 15th, 1919, a 50-foot tank of molasses ruptured, and because molasses is a non-Newtonian fluid, you don't want to be around a lot of it, and it killed 21 people and injured many more and did great damage to Boston. It was this huge disaster. You can visit the little memorial plaque on Commercial Street right next to, I think it's Langone Park in the North End today, and there's going to be some events in January to commemorate this, and one of them is you can go to a cafe and actually eat some molasses pastries, which I think is really strange that you'd want to eat molasses on the anniversary of this disaster. But Boston is a place that cares about history, and I think this this is a fun piece of history to relive.
That's Ed Lyons. He's a Massachusetts Republican. He uses the phrase non-Newtonian liquid, also a political writer and activist. Also with us is Susan Tracy, president of the Democratic consulting firm, The Strategy Group. She's also a former state rep. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston.